race. Podesta's frustration grew steadily toward the end of the summer. In August, he wasn't convinced Biden wouldn't run. By September 1st, he told friends he was hearing Biden had told labor leaders he would get in the race. By mid-September, he and the rest of Hillary's senior team were having meetings about how the campaign would respond to a Biden bid, replete with discussion of the political ammunition Hillary would use to attack the vice president. As the Clinton camp's assessment of Biden moved from guy keeping his options open to serious threat to enter and shake up the race, Mook and his lieutenants scrambled to set up operations in states that would vote after South Carolina's primary at the end of February. Prior to that, Mook had focused primarily on the first four contests on the calendar, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, and within that set, heavily on Iowa. But a Biden candidacy would increase the likelihood of an extended fight for the nomination, and Mook suddenly needed to show a presence in states that Hillary had largely ignored. The moment the campaign actually started doing stuff outside the first four states was when there was a serious possibility that Joe Biden was going to get into the race, one campaign aide acknowledged. Biden might be able to win a three-way race. Even if he didn't, he was strong enough, along with Sanders, to possibly deny Hillary the delegates needed to win the nomination on the first ballot at the Democratic National Convention. At that point, anything could happen. Chapter 6. Mrs. October. One evening in early September 2015, Robbie Mook stopped in at a private home in the coastal paradise of Bolinas, California, for what promised to be a relaxing break from the frenetic pace of running a campaign operation a continent away in Brooklyn. Instead, he ran into a buzzsaw in the form of Susie Tompkins Buell, a heavy-hitting donor and close friend of Hillary. As the fog of summer was still clearing, when few people paid close attention to politics, the New York Times had just published a story about a coming Clinton campaign strategy shift. Hillary would show more humor and heart, the headline declared. In the piece, Clinton's top aides, including Mook and Palmieri, admitted that there had been significant blunders made by the campaign, notably the months-long denial that there was a problem with her use of a private email server, and that the American public perceived her as too robotic and aloof. But, they promised, the real Hillary would emerge following Labor Day weekend. That Hillary, they claimed, was relatable to nearly anyone, downright funny, and didn't take herself too seriously. More than anything, they said, she was authentic. The image makeover was timed to preview Clinton's appearances on The Ellen DeGeneres Show, The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, and countless other lighthearted programs where Clinton would dance the nay-nay, reveal that she kept up with the Kardashians and Homeland, and ask hosts to playfully tug on her hair. Buell was displeased. By announcing a strategy to make Hillary seem more real, her team had actually achieved the opposite effect. Clinton supporters across the country read it the same way. It was a pure what-the-fuck moment, a major unforced error that buttressed qualms about Hillary's honesty and trustworthiness at a terrible time. Buell, channeling the collective outrage of the pro-Clinton forces, scolded Mook. "Why would you say something like that?" Buell demanded. "There's nothing more disingenuous than having the campaign quoted within the article." Mook didn't have a good explanation because there was no good explanation. Instead, he defended himself by assuring her that the campaign's data looked strong. To Buell, the precocious campaign manager was frustratingly left-brained. "You get so lost chasing the numbers," she thought. "They're like your gauge. You're distracted from your emotions, You just get driven to increase numbers. The campaign's inability to reveal Hillary's authenticity and its ham-fisted effort to manufacture a false version of it was infuriating. The Hillary Buell knew, foul-mouthed and fun, didn't need a bunch of political operatives inventing a more genuine persona for her. She needed them to help her drop the armor built up over decades that shielded her most human traits. Trying to placate Buell, Mook offered up Palmieri as a sacrifice. The large, domineering communications team was pretty much a separate shop within the operation, he campaign-splained. Palmieri and her staff had leaned too far over their skis because they were trying to rush away from the ugly summer of email and focus the media on the entertainment show tour they'd planned for Hillary. It was clear that in telegraphing the Hillary charm offensive, they had patted themselves on the back at the expense of the candidate's already damaged credibility. The campaign looked hapless. That's what worried people, said one Clinton backer familiar with Hillary's contributor network. That pissed more donors off. Buell was hardly alone in questioning the competence of the campaign. Calls, text messages, and emails from a number of Hillary allies bombarded the staff in the wake of the article. An inauthentic strategy to make her look authentic is absurd, fumed longtime Clinton ally Brent Badowski. One prominent Obama donor decried a campaign being run by amateurs and couldn't believe it would help manufacture a story about its efforts to alter the candidate's persona to make her seem more authentic. It was a joke. The campaign needed to contain the fallout from the story, and fast. Mook and Podesta tried to assuage angry donors across the country, and it was soon evident to staffers that they had hurt Hillary, not just with her adversaries, but with her most faithful supporters. They would later say they had participated in the story only after a reporter had caught wind of a shift in communications strategy. Still, her campaign looked like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. Under the gun to stall Sanders's momentum and convince Biden that there was no path for him to win the nomination, Hillary was instead reinforcing the idea that her rivals were more genuine characters. The email scandal had buried her already weak message and convinced the majority of Americans that she was a liar who couldn't be trusted. She had known from the start that her re-entry into the political space would cost her the stratospheric approval she'd enjoyed as Secretary of State. But like frogs who don't notice the water around them coming to a boil, Hillary and Bill took too long to appreciate just how much the email scandal and the candidate's refusal to simply apologize up front was poaching her image. Her long evolution to a more comprehensive sorry, punctuated in the interview with David Muir in September, helped stop the bleeding. But she needed to do more than just cauterize the wound, because the threat to her seemingly inevitable nomination was rising. Sanders was starting to catch fire in Iowa, and with the liberal white millennials who had replaced the intelligentsia as influencers in the virtual world. Biden was also looming. But in the seeds of the campaign's most recent screw-up lay the answer to her temporary salvation. Despite the tactical malpractice of rolling out the effort to humanize Hillary in such a clumsy fashion in the New York Times, the strategy of putting her on camera in more whimsical and humorous settings was a sound one. In early October, it provided her high beams and a GPS with which to find the road back to a position of strength. As she would time and again throughout the campaign, Hillary found her way by going home to New York. Her appearance on the season premiere of Saturday Night Live on October 3rd had been discussed at a very low level for months. It all came together in a whirl, just when Hillary most needed a moment of levity to free herself from the drudgery of a campaign that had been weighted down by emails. Luck, in this case, was the residue of design. The show's producers had one big question that week as they wrote Clinton into the script. Is there anything she won't do? No, Christina Shockey, Hillary's deputy communications director, replied. Hillary told her aides that she was open to the writer's vision for a skit. The idea was to show how she could roll with the punches. A tightly controlled segment wouldn't serve that end. Let's see what they come up with, she said to Shockey. They're the comic geniuses. The day before Clinton was set to appear on the show, she campaigned in South Florida and filled her coffers with a trio of fundraisers there. At the same time, she and Shockey reviewed the concept the Saturday Night Live writers had sketched out. So you'll play a waitress, Shockey told Clinton, a woman whose every need had been catered to over the past quarter of a century. Clinton liked the idea. That sounds really funny, she said. 24 hours before she would appear on the show, Clinton showed up at a Mark Anthony concert in downtown Miami, trying to make inroads with young Latino voters. Around 1 a.m., she flew back to Washington in time to appear at a human rights campaign breakfast on Saturday morning. Some comedy prep was necessary to ensure she wouldn't bomb, but the HRC breakfast wasn't something Clinton could put on the back burner. The most recognizable LGBT rights advocacy organization in the nation had the potential to be an important part of Clinton's coalition or a bulwark against her. She had implemented new policies at the State Department in accordance with the White House's wishes that extended same-sex partner benefits to bureaucrats overseas and had spoken eloquently on LGBT rights as human rights during her tenure in the Obama cabinet. But her late evolution to supporting gay marriage was a sticking point with younger members of the rank and file. It was a contrast point with Sanders and Biden. The Human Rights Campaign had wanted her to be the featured speaker at its annual dinner that night, but she'd declined so that she could appear on SNL. Her stand-in at the dinner? None other than Joe Biden, who had stepped out in front of Obama during the 2012 campaign cycle to announce on Meet the Press that he favored same-sex marriage. Hillary was on a political edge, in danger of ceding part of her coalition to the vice president. It wasn't until later that evening, standing in the show's green room on the eighth floor of the famed 30 Rock building, that Hillary finally practiced her role with a series of cue cards. Even as she read from the cards, the SNL writers were busy tweaking the lines. She had to practice several times, according to one person in the room, because her instinct was to interact with Kate McKinnon, the comedian who portrayed her, instead of robotically reading from the cue cards. For a candidate who was constantly being told she had to connect better with voters, the idea of glancing away from McKinnon to read her lines seemed to be a cheat. She shook off the awkwardness, and in the legendary Studio 8H, Hillary transformed from an overserved political animal to a steady-handed bartender, from someone struggling at all times to be heard to someone who earns her keep by listening. McKinnon as Hillary and Hillary as Val the bartender joked about Hillary's late arrival on a variety of positions, including her opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline and support of gay marriage. The net result? Viewers heard Clinton's current positions on the two issues and saw her poking fun at herself. At one point, McKinnon's Clinton lamented the rise of Trump. Ah, Val, I'm just so darned bummed. All anyone wants to talk about is Donald Trump, she says. The real Hillary played confused, but it was a moment she was prepared for. She'd been developing an impression of Trump since well before the SNL skit dropped in her lap, according to people close to her. and that portrayal was written in accordingly. Donald Trump? Isn't he the one that's like, "Ah, you're all losers," the real Hillary intoned. It's easy to assign too much meaning to a single Saturday Night Live performance. But Clinton's appearance garnered positive media attention, and it was the first rung in her ascent out of the depths of a 6-month campaign funk. It got the media talking about something other than the stultifying emails. It also provided a psychic boost for Hillary, who had felt the crushing weight of the email debacle, the threat of a Biden candidacy, the looming Benghazi hearing, Sanders's unexpectedly strong challenge, and the public judgment that she was dishonest. In that way, Saturday Night Live was the launch point for an October that proved to be the high point of 2015 for her. Chatter about a Biden candidacy heated up the week after the Human Rights Campaign dinner and Clinton's SNL appearance, and anti-Biden opposition research began surfacing in the media. Almost every policy knock against Clinton was a knock against Biden, too. And on some topics, he'd fare worse. Like Hillary, Biden was for the Iraq War before he was against it. And he was the Senate sponsor of the Clinton White House anti-crime law that had led to the mass incarceration of young black men. In addition, he'd ushered Clarence Thomas onto the Supreme Court, spent the early part of his career in the Senate trying to end school busing, and represented perhaps the most business-friendly tax haven in the nation, Delaware, for 36 years. As a lawmaker and as an Obama administration negotiator in the Senate, he never seemed terribly uncomfortable giving up items on the liberal wish list to get deals done. That didn't make him a bad guy. The bargaining had enacted a wide range of Democratic-leaning policies, but it left him vulnerable to lines of attack that would dredge up closed chapters of his past and introduce them to new audiences. Hillary, who had been reluctant to take a position on the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, moved to box Biden in. Liberals hated Obama's proposed pact with Pacific Rim countries because they believed it would result in jobs being shipped overseas, the lowering of labor standards in the United States, or both. Bernie was dead set against it and talked about his position frequently on the campaign trail. As Secretary of State, Hillary had helped negotiate the deal, and that meant coming out against it would be complicated politics. But Biden was in an even tougher spot. The central theme of his prospective candidacy would be defending Obama's legacy. Could the sitting vice president campaign against such a major piece of the president's second-term agenda, even if it was unpopular with the Democratic base? Probably not, her aides thought. But Sullivan wanted her to embrace TPP on a national security basis, specifically that it would create powerful alliances between the United States and a number of countries in China's sphere of influence. And he thought she could avoid a flip-flop label by doing that. Though Hillary was portrayed by opponents as an unrestrained free trader, her thinking was actually more nuanced than that. She heard Sullivan's view, understood it, and could even make the case he proposed without missing a beat. But she was concerned about the economic impacts on American workers. She just felt like there weren't enough winners, explained one advisor who spoke to her about the decision. She also understood the political imperative to be on the right side of big labor. On October 7th, she announced that she opposed the deal in typical Hillary fashion, with caveats and a lot of wiggle room. "As of today, I am not in favor of what I have learned about it," she told Judy Woodruff of PBS. "I don't believe it's going to meet the high bar I have set." She was conflicted enough about it that she didn't come out so forcefully as to convince union leaders or voters that she would kill it. Instead, she looked like she was pandering to them, and not well. Still, she was staking out important ground in advance of a possible Biden entry into the race. By the second week of October, the net Hillary had thrown around Biden had started to tighten uncomfortably. He stopped consulting with a larger circle of advisors and cut down to just a small handful of his most trusted confidants, including his son, Hunter. It was becoming increasingly difficult to find Democratic operatives or donors who could be counted on not to intentionally or unintentionally relay information about Biden's plans to Clinton World. The truth confronting Biden and his advisors was that, between Hillary's strategy for boxing out other Democrats and Biden's indecision, they simply hadn't built a strong enough foundation to mount a successful run. And now it was virtually impossible to construct a battle-worthy campaign machine. Biden had asked some national money bundlers and political allies in early states to be at the ready, but he hadn't put together anything close to the scale of the political operation Clinton had already built. He would have to pry Democratic donors, staff, and superdelegates away from a Clinton campaign that could credibly argue at the time that it would be political suicide to leave her for Biden. As much as the Clinton team worried about Biden, Biden rightly worried that he could go down in flames. It was the kind of thing that only the voters could sort out, and the risks of having to relive the tragic losses of his first wife and two of his children, and of tarnishing his own legacy, were big obstacles to overcome. Still, as two of the most portentous moments of 2015 drew close on the calendar, the first Democratic debate and Clinton's testimony before the House Select Committee on Benghazi, Biden hadn't made a final decision. It appeared that he was waiting to see how Clinton performed in the spotlight. As Biden played Hamlet in the VP's office, Hillary rehearsed for her first big political performance of the season, the opening Democratic debate. Unlike Hillary, Bernie had no experience debating at the presidential level. But he did have positions that more neatly fit the activist-heavy Democratic primary electorate. Bernie would portray her as out of touch with progressive values. Hillary thought he was out of touch with the realities of governance. It frustrated her no end that Bernie would promise the moon without offering a plan to get there. Raising the minimum wage and college tuition assistance were prime examples of Sanders's digging in at an outpost on the left and making Hillary look cautious, conservative, and very much a creature of the establishment. Every time she said she wanted to increase the federal minimum wage to $12 an hour, the main proposal from Senate Democrats, Bernie said he'd settle for no less than 15 bucks. When she said she wanted students to emerge from college without debt, Bernie reminded voters that his plan would let them attend for free. Hillary's advisors thought it was reminiscent of the scene from There's Something About Mary, in which a crazed hitchhiker tells Ben Stiller's character that he can make a fortune by turning 8-minute abs into 7-minute abs. "She's 7-minute abs," said one of her advisors. "This guy's fucking 4-minute abs." The other issue that weighed heavily on Clinton's mind before the debate was that she couldn't go negative on Bernie. He could bore into her on the debate stage, but she couldn't risk fighting back too hard against the well-liked underdog. Sanders had a patina of purity, and from the Clinton campaign's perspective, was getting an even easier ride from the media than Obama had in 2008. Bernie could leverage that purity to attack her more aggressively. Sanders knew there was a risk to his brand, but he was ever more willing to take it as he climbed in the polls and saw a chance to win the nomination. Where Obama had made subtle character contrasts with Clinton, Sanders was leaning even harder into the public's belief that she was dishonest, implying that she was bought and paid for by donors on Wall Street and in the fossil fuel industry. The combination of an edge on pure liberalism and driving at character issues had helped Sanders surge. In national polling, he had cut a 50-point Clinton lead to about 20 points. In a couple of polls conducted in Iowa in late August and early September, he actually passed her before she managed to rebound. As Hillary went round and round with her debate prep partners at the Doral Arrowwood Hotel in Westchester, New York, she and her team sought to answer the question of how she could beat him on policy. The simple solution would have been to move to his left, but Hillary couldn't afford to flip-flop all over the debate stage, and she didn't want to trap herself into liberal positions that would be hard to defend in the general election. Instead, she went back to a tactic familiar to anyone who followed the 2008 Democratic primary. She would try to blunt Sanders' attacks by saying they were both progressives, and then pivot by asserting that she could actually enact her plans. She had tried unsuccessfully to do this to Obama. The calculation now was that it would work better against Sanders, who was plainly more liberal than the president. She hoped the framework would appeal to voters who weren't quite sure Sanders could effect the changes he promised on the campaign trail. Then, a few days before the debate, Sanders handed Hillary a gift. During an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, Sanders was asked whether he was a capitalist. "No," Sanders replied. "I'm a democratic socialist." Checkmate. Bernie had just anchored himself to a position so far to the left on such an elemental question of political philosophy that she wouldn't have to do much heavy lifting to portray him as too far on the fringe. Hillary believed the Democratic Party, the one she knew, would never nominate someone who publicly rejected capitalism and embraced socialism. In her establishment-aligned mind, capitalism was the force that drove entrepreneurs and small businesses, a sector of the economy that many Democrats could identify with much more easily than the financial services industry that Sanders tied her to with great effect. She knew instantly that it would be a topic of conversation in the debate, and she believed she could score points on it. Fortune was turning in her direction, if ever so slightly. But there was one line of attack that former Maryland governor and long-shot candidate Martin O'Malley had pursued that had the Clinton team worried, particularly with the prospect of both of her legitimate rivals pounding her on it. Former Virginia Senator Jim Webb and former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee would also be on stage for the debate, but would not factor into the race. O'Malley had been hitting Clinton hard on her email scandal, not on the substance of it, but rather on how enduring it had become. The basic case he made, again and again, was that it was such a distraction that it prevented Democrats from making a positive case about their agenda for the American people. It had certainly sidetracked Hillary, and the other candidates were having trouble breaking through too. It was a powerful attack, because it was true. Hillary drew two conclusions. She would be asked about the emails first, and O'Malley would go harshly negative on the scandal. Her fear was that Sanders would be able to slide in between and talk about the real issues confronting the American public, rising above a petty fight between O'Malley and Clinton. He could win the exchange that way. Her aides believed she needed to take control of the issue quickly by making the argument that there were more important issues than the emails. "We wanted to get her there first," one aide said. "Her getting there first neutralizes the whole deal." In her final prep session, on the day of the debate, Clinton was reflective. Hillary could sense that her tuner was off, and that gnawed at her. "I'm really trying to put my finger on what the electorate, the Democratic primary electorate, the broader electorate, is thinking and feeling right now," she told an advisor. "What is the appeal of a Sanders, and what are their concerns about me?" she wanted to know how she should calibrate in terms of the Obama legacy, whether Democrats wanted to build on it or make more dramatic changes. Sanders' success was evidence that some preferred the latter, but how many? It wasn't clear, but she and her team believed that most Democrats thought Obama was on the right track. Here she was, 6 months into her campaign, having traveled the country, and she still didn't quite grasp the underlying sentiments of the electorate. Sanders had tapped into feelings that she couldn't access. When Clinton sequestered herself with a small retinue of staff in a trailer outside the Wynn Las Vegas before that first debate on October 13, 2015, she was in a somber mood. She said nothing as she walked into the arena, flanked by a Praetorian guard of Podesta, Sullivan, debate coaches Ron Klain and Karen Dunn, Secret Service officers, and television producers. The silence was unsettling. Bernie was coming on strong, and this would be his first chance to prove that he was a real contender for the nomination. It was time for her to fight for her political life, for her values and her ambitions, and she didn't seem like she was in the right frame of mind for a scrap. "She's going to be too subdued," Sullivan thought. Bernie, the underdog with the wind at his back and a rare gift for electrifying the party base, would bring his energy and charisma into the arena. But would Hillary muster the acuity to execute her game plan? Sullivan needn't have worried. Her outward calm, at a time when pulses raced on both sides of the Clinton-Sanders divide, betrayed nothing of the powerful, low-humming debate machine that was being brought to a purr inside. In the opening minutes, she turned the question of her level of commitment to progressive values into a weapon. "I'm a progressive," she said, pausing for a beat to set up an implicit criticism of Sanders. "But I'm a progressive who likes to get things done." Sanders walked right into a trap when he was asked about his embrace of socialism, bringing up the C word, capitalism, that Hillary was waiting to hear. "Well, we're gonna win because first, we're gonna explain what democratic socialism is," he said. "Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little? By which Wall Street's greed and recklessness wrecked this economy? No, I don't. I believe in a society where all people do well, not just a handful of billionaires." Bernie was offering a window into his desire to sell a brand new system of governance, unlike the American experience. "I love Denmark," Hillary mocked lightly. "We are the United States of America." "Rein in capitalist excesses," she said, "but it would be a grave mistake to turn our backs on what built the greatest middle class in the world." She had hugged America and turned Bernie into an exotic European elitist. Good for the primary, better for the general. Not only would he fail to recover, but he quickly wandered into a bigger trap set by a combination of Clinton's student-like preparation and a generous helping of his own bad luck. As she had hoped, Hillary got the first crack at a question about her emails. President Obama had just called it a legitimate issue, Anderson Cooper reminded, and she mentally plucked the right page from her playbook. "Tonight, I want to talk not about my emails, but about what the American people want from the next president of the United States," she said, stealing what she thought would be Sanders's approach. Let me say something that may not be great politics," he said. "But I think the secretary is right, and that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails." Hillary didn't give him a chance to finish his thought. She moved toward him, clasped his hand, and barely containing her glee, said, "Thank you! Me too! Me too!" The audience roared its approval. While his advisors had pushed him to seize on the email controversy in the lead-up to the debate and the practice sessions at his hotel in Henderson, Nevada, Sanders told them he would not. "I'm not going to attack her," he told them. "I'm going to talk about the issues. It's not an issue as far as I'm concerned." And when Clinton tried to close the door on the scandal as a primary campaign issue, Sanders put a lock on it. While his senior aides were at odds with the candidate on the approach, it satisfied them. "We had the soundbite. He won," one of the advisors said. "It wasn't the greatest argument in the world, but at least it was an argument." It would also be the most potent moment of the debate for Hillary, one the cable networks played repeatedly in the highlights of the matchup. She had been struggling to get the electorate to look past the email issue and move on. But with her opponent's help, it seemed like she might finally get the oxygen she needed to talk about policy, the only thing she ever felt comfortable discussing in elections. Bernie would later note that there was still an ongoing investigation, but as Clinton and her team had hoped, the anchor weighing down her campaign had been lifted, at least for a little while, within the confines of the Democratic primary. Afterward, Clinton was, as usual, unsure of her own performance. How had she handled the big moments? What did it look like to viewers? Had she made her points effectively? "What do you guys think?" she asked as she caught up with her top aides backstage. "How did I do?" They knew she had cleaned Bernie's clock. "You killed it," one of them responded. "Really?" she asked. "Really," she was assured. But if Hillary was the candidate who won the debate, Bernie wasn't the one who lost it. That was Joe Biden. The reviews coming out of Clinton's debate debut were strong enough to make Biden's lane look much narrower than it had just a few hours earlier. That put Biden in a precarious position, caught with a very short moment in which to make an announcement and a resurgent rival. Hillary hadn't stumbled. She'd looked capable. Fewer Democrats were questioning whether she was a potential zombie candidate, one who was unstoppable in the primary but unelectable in the general. Bernie had even absolved her of the email scandal. The day after the debate, in an interview with Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC, Podesta squeezed Biden further. "If Vice President Biden wants to enter and compete for the presidency," Podesta said, "then it is time he make that decision." The window for Biden was closing, not opening. If he waited until after her upcoming Benghazi hearings, said one source with ties to both the Biden and Clinton worlds, it was going to look like Benghazi was what caused him to get in. For a politician who would stake his candidacy on his authenticity and who had delayed making a decision so his family could grieve his son's death, jumping into the race after Clinton was hauled before a partisan committee might smack of opportunism and undermine his narrative. And the optics of waiting around for Clinton to fall, of perhaps pressuring her into a misstep, didn't sit well with many Democrats. Whatever they thought of Clinton's handling of the email situation, Democrats were uniformly behind her on the larger question of whether she was to blame for the September 2012 attacks that killed four Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, in Benghazi, Libya. Their support had been solidified a few weeks earlier when House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy made the inexplicably poor political decision to tie the Benghazi committee's existence to Clinton's falling poll numbers. "Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee, a select committee. What are her numbers today? Her numbers are dropping," McCarthy had said in late September. The remark was such an incredible gaffe. An outright affirmation that an entire congressional committee had spent millions of dollars politicizing the deaths of Americans to hurt her presidential hopes, that it factored heavily in the GOP's decision not to elevate McCarthy to Speaker of the House after John Boehner retired. Between Kevin McCarthy and Bernie Sanders, they bookended her on that, and may have just made it to where it would be really difficult to do anything, one Clinton ally said after the debate. I think that may have shaken Biden. Whatever effect it had, the die was cast. On October 21st, the day before the Benghazi hearing, Biden went to the Rose Garden with Obama and Second Lady Jill Biden at his side to announce that he wouldn't seek the presidency. The collective sigh of relief from Clinton's Brooklyn headquarters was almost audible on the White House lawn. At Rural Society, an Argentine restaurant across the street from the Washington Post, Jeff Weaver and Tad Devine from Sanders' team sat down at the bar to watch Biden speak. They had always believed it was better for them if Biden ran, because it would be easier to defeat Hillary in a three-way race than a head-to-head competition. And they thought Biden was more likely to take votes from Hillary than from Bernie. This had all the makings of a downer. But halfway through the vice president's remarks, they realized the subtext of Biden's message. He was calling for free college for kids, railing against big money donors, and promising to actively defend Obama's legacy against any candidate who challenged it, as Hillary had done at times. Weaver and Devine were gleeful. Biden was validating Bernie's message as he bowed out, and better yet, he wasn't going to run on it himself. It was also hard to miss the contrast with Hillary. Devine excitedly turned to Weaver. "That's our speech," he exclaimed. It was an amazingly partisan and anti-Clinton sentiment to express from the pulpit of the American government. But it was Biden's political swan song for the 2016 election cycle. Hillary was grateful for that, if more than a little distracted by her impending rendezvous with House Republicans. 2 days earlier, Hillary had summoned aides to Whitehaven for murder boards, the D.C. slang for prep sessions before a contentious congressional hearing. Philippe Raines, Brian Fallon, and a newcomer, former Obama White House aide Phil Schillero, were among those who sat down with her around a dining room table that had become Hillary's Washington nerve center for major deliberations. They wanted her to watch her P's and Q's from the witness table. But Hillary was in fighting mode after 3 years of investigations into her role in the Benghazi attacks. "I'm sick and tired of this," she thought from her seat at the head of the table. "This has been probed 8 times. I'm going to stand up to these guys once and for all." She clearly wanted to be 1 degree more than feisty, said one advisor who was in the room. Her staff quickly realized that if they didn't talk her down, she might erupt on camera. They wanted her to think about rising above the committee. "It was the first and last piece of advice that everyone gave," said an aide who was there. Over the course of 3 days of mock hearings, Hillary's aides and advisors peppered her with questions they thought the Republicans on the Benghazi committee would ask. And they did it in ways intended to get under Hillary's skin. Raines, foreshadowing a later role on the campaign, played what he thought of as an amalgam of the idiot contingent on the committee. That included Georgia Republican Lynn Westmoreland, who liked to imply that the Benghazi deaths were the result of Hillary being asleep at the switch. Bill Clinton, who had sided with Hillary's aides about the importance of her demeanor, wandered in and out during the prep sessions, laughing at Raines' version of a hillbilly congressman. Cheryl Mills and Jake Sullivan knew the committee's lines of inquiry well, as each of them had already testified before it. Hillary had started the murder boards with a strong grasp of U.S. policy in Libya and the details of the terrorist attack there. But she still couldn't understand what one aide called the pathologies underlying the case that her handling of Benghazi should disqualify her from the presidency. For hours at a time, only pausing for lunch, they walked her through all the Republican narratives that had taken hold to date, as well as the fever dreams and the conspiracy stuff that moved well beyond security issues at the Benghazi compound, the aide said. By the end of 3 days of drills and coaching, she'd lost her desire to punch back and just wanted to get through this trial by fire. Her team had succeeded in tempering her instinct to fight. On the morning of the hearing, October 22, 2015, Hillary and nearly a dozen of her lawyers, advisors, and aides filed into a conference room in the suite controlled by the committee's Republicans to await the start of the proceedings. Amid bookshelves and a small kitchenette, both sides acknowledged the awkwardness of Hillary and her team discussing the investigation in the offices of a GOP committee that had spent the better part of 2 years probing her private communications. Republican Chairman Trey Gowdy's aides even offered to sweep the room for listening devices, an olive branch that was declined in exactly the self-consciously polite manner in which it was extended. The moment was more than awkward, though. It was drenched in tension. For any presidential candidate, a campaign presents a series of high-stakes challenges. But testifying before a congressional panel for the better part of a day was unusual, to say the least. A Republican tribunal would have hours on end to try to take down the likely Democratic presidential nominee in a taxpayer-funded forum broadcast across the nation. Hillary would sit alone at the witness table, facing inquisitors on a dais, knowing that anything she said could and would be used against her in a political ad. As the minutes before her testimony ticked away, Hillary's aides began to think their murder boards might have overdone the intensity with which the Republican members of the committee would come after her. That was the goal, to be so aggressive in the murder boards that the hearing seemed like a breeze for Hillary. But once the hearing began, they realized they had erred too much on the side of civility. In his opening statement, Gowdy self-righteously beat his chest, telling the national audience that the investigation was about finding the truth, about the mission in Libya, requests for more personnel, and why our military was positioned as it was on the anniversary of 9/11. Not that Hillary was responsible for the posture of the Defense Department as Secretary of State. Then he addressed Hillary directly. Madam Secretary, I understand there are people, frankly, in both parties, who have suggested that this investigation is about you. Let me assure you it is not. And let me assure you why it is not, he said, wrapping himself in the flag. This investigation is about four people who were killed representing our country on foreign soil. He delivered with such dramatic intonation that he might as well have been Tom Cruise in the film A Few Good Men, grilling Jack Nicholson about whether he'd ordered the code red. Gowdy and his colleagues truly seemed to believe they could produce a smoking gun that showed Hillary had demonstrated poor judgment, ineptitude, neglect, or malice. However, they clearly underestimated the possibility that she would be the one who would stay cool, stick to the facts, and make them look ridiculously partisan. And that was exactly what happened. Long before lunchtime, the political press, the conservative intelligentsia, and the entirety of the Democratic universe had decided that Hillary was pulverizing her Republican interlocutors. Savvy Republicans tweeted that it was hard to watch their representatives in Congress failing to score points on Hillary, and Democrats delighted in pointing out just how crazy some of the lines of questioning were. As Hillary concentrated more intently on ensuring that viewers could hear her side of the story, Republican lawmakers lost their focus. The more even Hillary's keel, the more they pushed to capsize her. Several of them insinuated that she cared more about her reputation than the lives of the four men who died. Alabama Republican Martha Roby may have taken the cake by demanding to know whether Hillary had spent the wee hours of the morning alone at home after she left the State Department on the night of the Benghazi attacks. In the final hour of the nearly 11-hour marathon hearing, just after 8:30 in the evening, Hillary broke into a coughing fit. She sipped a glass of water but continued to cough. Gowdy asked if she'd like a 60-second break to catch her breath. But in a scene made for Hollywood, Clinton said no. "Let me just grab," she said, clearing her throat, "a lozenge." After reaching for the cough drop and popping it in her mouth, she continued, powering through with a bit more rasp in her voice. Through it all, Hillary maintained her composure. Even before the hearing had concluded, the media had drawn its conclusion. She'd whipped Gowdy and his crew of amateur interrogators. When Kansas Representative Mike Pompeo had gotten into it with Clinton, the conservative writer John Podhoretz tweeted, "Why doesn't Pompeo just go over and swear her in for president now? If he goes on like this, he'll practically get her elected." The candidate herself felt like a championship boxer who had weathered a long but never close bout against an inferior challenger. After walking back into the conference room in the GOP's committee headquarters, Hillary pantomimed her exhaustion. She slumped her shoulders and made the front of her body concave, drawing laughter from advisors who could also finally relax. She hugged Sullivan, Mills, and Fallon. She dispatched Nick Merrill, the erstwhile traveling press secretary, to find out what Gowdy was telling reporters. Merrill reported back quickly. Gowdy had said he'd learned nothing new from the hearing. Republicans had inadvertently staged an 11-hour infomercial testament to her competence, soundness of mind, compassion for the victims of the Benghazi attack, and serenity in a crisis. It was worse than a waste of time for congressional Republicans. It was the high water mark of Hillary's campaign so far. She looked presidential in comparison to her adversaries. And yet, her best performance had come under the umbrella of a Benghazi investigation that naturally portrayed her as the defendant. Survival was a victory, but no other candidate had to endure the horrible optics of being hauled before a congressional committee to testify about the deaths of four Americans. Regardless of whether she outmaneuvered the Republicans on the committee, they had nothing to lose. And many voters were either incensed about her handling of Benghazi or exhausted by the cloud of scandal that seemed to follow her. It might be unfair, but the GOP could score points against her just by reminding voters that she was often under investigation. After Merrill's report, the team huddled to discuss whether she should respond to what Gowdy had said. There was nothing more Hillary could gain. "You know what?" Palmieri said, announcing a reprieve. "Just go home." With the Benghazi hearing behind her, Biden out of the race, and Bernie breathing down her neck, she'd need her reserves for the 3-month sprint to the Iowa caucuses. Chapter 7. I was certain we were going to lose. Bill Clinton was pissed off. He hollered at John Podesta loud enough to be heard through the walls of the little anteroom he'd laid claim to on the 10th floor of the historic Savory Hotel in downtown Des Moines, Iowa. It was the goddamn pundits he was watching on TV. They were getting it all wrong again as the results of the Iowa caucuses trickled in. Hillary was leading, but it was going to be tight. "OMG," Wolf Blitzer said on CNN. "It doesn't get a whole lot closer than that." That assessment invited parallels to Hillary's 2008 loss to Barack Obama. It was, in Bill's view, an absurd comparison. After all, that had been a three-way race, and she was still likely to come out the winner on this night, not the third-place finisher. But journalists saw an upstart challenger competing with her in Iowa, and deja vu was a hard storyline to resist. This outcome tonight ensures that this race is going to go on for months and months on the Democratic side, Blitzer's colleague Jeff Zeleny reported that night from Sanders' headquarters. The perception all along had been that Hillary was such a prohibitive frontrunner heading into the Democratic nomination fight that she should have cleaned up easily. Bill had a much different perspective. Iowa had never been Clinton country, and Hillary had increased her share of the caucus return from under 30% in 2008 to 50%, give or take a little, in 2016. Plus, unlike Obama, Bernie was tailor-made for Iowa. The state is overwhelmingly white, littered with colleges, and decidedly working class in its cities. Even if Bernie managed to eke out a victory, this was Hillary showing strength, not weakness. Why couldn't they see the difference? On one level, it was just another of Bill's routine fits about television personalities. He'd cursed Tim Russert's name after the Meet the Press host had declared Obama the winner of the 2008 primary in May of that year. But it was also another sign of his inability to tamp down his emotions at pivotal moments in his wife's political career. At the start of the day, he'd gone for a walk with his aides to try to release some of the building stress, and at one point he played Oh Hell, a combination of the card games Spades and Bullshit, with them. He was a protective husband and a concerned Democrat, and now he was shouting 8 years of pent-up frustrations at his longtime friend and advisor. When Bill had spent himself, Podesta calmly walked into an adjoining space that was part of the Clinton suite for caucus night. There, amid Hillary's phalanx of anxiety-ridden consultants, he found the man he was looking for, Iowa State Director Matt Paul. Balding, bespectacled, and in his mid-40s, Paul had left his job as communications director for Agriculture Secretary and former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack to run Hillary's Iowa operation. He had been with her at stops across the state for the better part of a year. Having served on Howard Dean's presidential campaign in Iowa, and as a former aide to Vilsack and Senator Tom Harkin, Paul knew the state's electorate as well as anyone. Podesta beckoned Paul with a quick but pointed nod. You go in there and deal with him. Paul gathered himself and walked in to find the former president sitting in a leather chair. Bill was wearing a suit and a pair of leather gloves. His arms were crossed. Even if the yelling hadn't been audible through the walls of the boutique hotel, it would have been clear that he was in a foul mood. His eyes were fixed on Paul. If there's ever a time to make sure I know my shit, the staffer thought, this is it. Bill fired questions at him. What's still outstanding in Polk County? What about Johnson County? And how about Cedar Rapids? Paul walked Bill through the state, and where caucus results still hadn't been reported, county by county. Slowly the president's anger subsided, even if his anxiety didn't. Hillary had gotten out to a lead consistent with where her team thought she would be, heading into caucus night. She was up a handful of points. But Sanders was steadily closing in on her. After Paul briefed Bill, the two men repeated their conversation in the nearby room where the rest of Hillary's team was nervously assessing the situation. Even in front of the others, Bill bore down on Paul. One source in the room noted a marked shift in Bill's personality. Usually, when you're with him, he's a storyteller, the source said. On this night, he was just an information gatherer. He wanted to know what the staff didn't know and why they didn't know it. It's much harder to figure out who is winning in a caucus state, and particularly in Iowa, because the results aren't measured in votes cast. Instead, they are reported as the number of state delegate equivalents, based on the proportion of the vote that each candidate gets from his or her performance at caucus locations. The numbers can come in as very small fractions. Over and over, Paul gave updates to the former president, or, more often, reports that there weren't meaningful updates, but remained upbeat, if not rosy, about Hillary's chances of pulling it out. Paul concluded that what really mattered was which caucus sites in Polk County remained unreported. If they were in the core of Des Moines, Hillary was screwed. If they were outside the city, she would win. Pollster John Anzalone, who also knew the state like the roads around his Alabama home, looked at the same numbers and got a bad feeling. He back-channeled to Podesta while Paul was reporting to Bill. "This is not getting better," he told Podesta. "This is going to keep going down. He could potentially overtake us." At the outset of the campaign, there were two schools of thought on the proper expectations for Hillary's performance in Iowa. On the one hand, it was never supposed to be this close. Hillary had done everything she could to clear the Democratic primary field. She'd lined up money, key endorsements, and the top available talent. When Hillary first set foot in Iowa in April 2015, on her soft launch road trip in a black Chevrolet Express 1500 dubbed the Scooby Van, she was determined not to repeat the mistakes that had doomed her to a third place in 2008. Few remembered that her Iowa bronze medal had netted her 14 delegates, just one fewer than first-place finisher Barack Obama. For all the importance of delegate math in winning a Democratic presidential nomination, Iowa was always about the narrative. Taking the caucuses, no matter the margin, had outsized influence in the way a candidate was regarded by the national media, donors, and voters in other states. The Iowa effect had propelled Obama to the nomination in 2008. The second school of thought recognized that there was pre-existing hostility to Hillary and her worldview in the state, and that it was never going to be an easy win if there was another legitimate Democratic candidate. In three previous campaigns in Iowa, a Clinton campaign had won just once. In 1996, when Bill, the sitting president, was running for renomination unopposed. Iowa Democrats, a progressive and overwhelmingly white set, had reasons to seek an alternative to Hillary. Many of them didn't like her hawkishness or her close ties to the financial services industry, which had plied her with campaign contributions and given her astronomical personal speaking fees. Iowa, for them, is this kind of thing that's fucked them over and over and over again, said one aide of the Clintons. They were nervous about it from the start. But her expectations and those of the professional political class were at odds. She and Bill thought it was a tough state. Everyone else thought anything short of a clear victory would be a failure. Paul, her Iowa state director, started gearing up for the campaign in March 2015, the month before Hillary announced that she was running. He pursued a pretty straightforward organizing strategy, lock down the Democratic machinery, precinct by precinct, and make sure that every Clinton-leaning Democrat in the state felt that he or she was in constant contact with the campaign. Throughout the early months of the campaign, even as Hillary was struggling to get her message across and as Sanders began to gain steam, Clinton's team on the ground in Iowa was busy at work with the blocking and tackling of organizing supporters. She had failed to do that in 2008. Back then, her aides had assured her she was fine when she was not, and she would be a stickler in 2016 for details on how many people attended each of her events, how many pledges of support had been signed by caucus-goers, and how many times she had met with each county party chairman. Of course, Hillary had the support of big-name Iowa Democrats like Harkin and Vilsack, a former two-time governor. But the approach was to permeate the lower levels of Democratic elected officials and liberal interest groups. That was the way to deny rivals the institutional support that could help them organize their campaigns, as Hillary built hers. Sanders, by contrast, was building without the infrastructure a candidate typically needs to compete in the Iowa caucuses. Like his online fundraising, his base of support in Iowa grew organically. By the summer of 2015, he was riding a wave. The media called it the Sanders surge, and it would grow and grow. Still, with three previous Iowa campaigns between them, Hillary and Bill were convinced that it was next to impossible for a candidate to win the caucuses without traditional organizing. I knew it always stuck in the back of her mind, always stuck in the back of Bill's mind, one Clinton advisor recalled of the former first couple's take on Sanders' momentum. Can you do this purely on energy in the state? How do you have to harness it? How much do you have to organize? Even with all of that, you've got to organize it. In the lead-up to her campaign announcement, advisors had urged Hillary to compete hard in Iowa, hyper-localize the issues in the state, and get to know Iowans, something she couldn't do on a rope line. Where her husband could charm at a rally or one-on-one, Hillary was most impressive and most comfortable in small groups. She could listen to a dozen voters and their stories at a table, then go back around it and repeat everyone's name and concerns before offering her take. In doing so, she demonstrated that she had been listening to them more than most politicians. Iowa voters expect a chance to meet with presidential candidates in person, to get to know them and take stock of them. In that way, the state's caucuses are the closest most presidential candidates get to old-school retail campaigning. Some front-runners prefer large rallies. Sanders and Trump would do a lot of that. But Hillary wanted to campaign like an underdog, which would both give her face time with Iowans and, she hoped, present her as something other than the anointed candidate. An aide involved in the Iowa strategy said the round table model also allowed the campaign to start off at a sustainable pace and gave Hillary grist for future meetings with like